Global consumerism is a $40 trillion a year phenomenon, which makes it the largest, most predictable investment opportunity on the planet. Who are the prime beneficiaries of global consumption trends? Mega brands. Welcome to the Mega Brands podcast series. I'm your host, Eric Clark. In this podcast, we explore mega trends through the lens of a global investor with the ultimate goal of identifying the most relevant, most innovative brands that are best positioned to become what I call mega brands. These are the brands that are customer obsessed, have a corporate culture of innovation and self-disruption, create products and services that are in high demand, that exhibit strong brand love from customers, are serving a global opportunity, and appeal to multiple demographic groups. What's the reward for a company that meets these criteria? More revenue, more cash flow, higher market share, and the potential to reach the $1 trillion club. Please enjoy our next episode of Mega Brands.
Eric Clark is the portfolio manager for the Rational Dynamic Brands Fund in conjunction with his partners at Acuvest Global Advisors. All opinions expressed by Eric and podcast guests are solely their own opinions and do not reflect the opinions of Acuvest Global Advisors or Rational Funds. This podcast is for informational purposes only and should not be relied upon as a basis for investment decisions. Clients of the Brands Fund or Acuvest may maintain positions in the securities discussed in this podcast.
Hey, everybody. Happy New Year. It's Eric Clark, Dynamic Brands Portfolio Manager. We focus on global consumer spending trends here at Acuvest. Wednesday, January 10th. And I wanted to summarize our year-end fund letter. We've created it in paper version, but lots of people like to read it. I am one of those. I listen to an enormous amount of audio content versus reading. And I know that's a big thing for a lot of people. So, you know, 2023 was a much more pleasant year, obviously, as an investor. And our team, you know, expected this. No, we cannot predict the future, but our experience over, you know, navigating markets over 30 years taught us to expect much better outcomes when you're willing to buy at highly attractive prices. And that's what we had in 2022. The market radically overreacted to interest rate hikes. But we know we live in an algorithmic world where things are just rules-based. And if rates are rising fast and the Fed is not your friend, then just sell stocks. And they didn't really take any fundamentals into consideration. The vast majority of the stocks that we follow had zero problem navigating through higher interest rates, higher cost of capital, because they're leaders in their business. Most of them don't rely on debt to fuel growth. And they're leaders in industries. And so, you know, before I get into this, I do want to remind people of something. You know, when we got the pandemic in early 2020, the reality is lots of things changed. There were massive distortions across virtually every economy, every sector, supply chains, employment, working from home versus going to the office, shipping costs, et cetera, right? So the last couple of years for most companies and the indexes has been way below average. And, you know, that never is fun to go through. But the good news as we come out of that two-year stack is that the economy is healing slowly. Interest rates are probably set to fall a little bit from here. Inflation has been falling and we're getting back to normal. And for some businesses, they've already mean reverted back to pre-pandemic levels at the margin level, at the growth, at the store count, at the store growth, you know, all of the things that they were doing pre-pandemic, they're getting back to doing. Other industries and other companies are changed. Some are radically changed. Some are partially changed. And so, you know, you have to take all of that into consideration when you're deciding what you want to own for 2024 and beyond, because there have been some changes. But one thing doesn't change: consumers spending money on things they want and things they need. It's never changed. We are programmed as humans. If we have a little money in our pocket, we spend that money on something that makes us happy or something that we need. And that's why this strategy and this theme is so important to a portfolio. You know, 70% of the portfolio, or the economy, is consumer spending, and a little bit more than that is business investment. And that's really what we focus on: how consumers are spending their time and their money, how businesses are spending their time and their money, because it's such an enormous part of the economy. You're talking 50 plus trillion around the world. And I don't know that anybody would disagree that $50 trillion of a thematic is probably worth having inside of a portfolio. To me, it's the most ideal core, for obvious reasons, because the definition of core is the most important part of something. If the most important part of the economy is spending, then you should have a dedicated allocation to spending. And we do that through the leading companies in the most important spending categories across business spending and consumer spending. So with that in mind and all the distortions, as a consumer investor, we want to find out how consumers are spending their time and their money today. And the reality is, after, you know, almost 3 years, 2.5 at least, we have been overspending everywhere. Not because we want to, but because we were forced to. Everybody raised prices everywhere. And some of those have since mean reverted, particularly on the goods economy. Lots of those prices have come back down to earth as inventory levels have been, you know, that were bloated and are now getting back to normal. But there's lots of other places where spending, particularly on the service side, prices, are still a little bit high. And so consumers are making choices. They will continue to make choices. We have to spend on certain things: groceries, gas for our cars, you know, those kinds of things, the everyday needs, the staples of life. But, and we have to spend on things that we love and we just can't live without. And that's really where we're focused. And so we are much more intrigued by the service economy currently than we are on the goods. We do have some names like a Nike, which has underperformed really for the last couple of years. We have Lululemon on the good side. We have TJ Maxx on the trade down side. So we definitely have some exposure to the quote goods economy, but we really like the service economy, and we like consumer electronics, technology, this AI theme as well. And that's kind of where we're positioned. So we're still a little bit more concentrated than we have been in the past, because the economy isn't broadly working on all cylinders, right? The Fed stepped in to fight inflation, and they essentially put a big tape over businesses and consumers saying, halt, don't spend, reduce your spend, be cautious. They created a lot of uncertainty. They did that so we could try to bring inflation down, and they've largely been successful at bringing it down, not to the point where they're completely satisfied, but certainly we're well on our way. Now, the good news about, you know, an economy that's running on two cylinders of four is that when the Fed decides to step back a little bit, get in the back seat, and I wish they'd do that yesterday, because they are still too powerful a force in the economy. They just need to take a step, get in the back seat, and stay there until we're needed, until we need you. But over time, the Fed stepping back, being less restrictive, interest rates maybe pulling back a little bit, Fed funds pulling back a little bit, that's going to stimulate growth. It's going to reduce uncertainty. And when uncertainty is reduced, corporations can plan better. They start their spending. Consumers start spending more broadly. Then the economy and the stock market will broaden out. So we certainly see sometime in 2024 where we are going to broaden out in the names that we own. We're just not quite there yet. We've broadened out a little bit, but I suspect we'll broaden out even more sometime over the next, you know, 2 to 4 months or so. So Let's look at the fund for 2023. The fund was up 42.5 versus the S&P 500 up 26. So some strong alpha for the year. And, you know, those gains essentially came from three factors. One, the willingness to obtain attractive prices in 2022, buying good businesses when they're on sale. That's so logical, but it's very hard for people to do sometimes when the news flow is negative and stock prices are down and trending lower, people freeze. And, you know, to be honest with you, I love buying things on dips. When I traded for a living for 7 years, I used to be in a trading group. They used to call me the knife catcher because I love to buy great merchandise when nobody wants it, because that's when the greatest prices happen. And purchase price matters. You've heard it from Apollo Global, if you're a follower of the private equity and private credit brands, purchase price matters. So number two, a dedication to the quality style factor, which we're always anchored to. That's the core of the strategy. We're willing to go outside of the core for some satellite opportunities if we see those emerge. But the quality style factor had a really difficult year in 2022 and has since come back pretty strongly. And it tends to win more often than not. And we tend to be anchored on where brands live, and that's consumer discretionary, technology and communication services, with a little bit of healthcare and staples, generally speaking. And consumer discretionary, technology and comm services were the best performing sectors of 2023. That's where we focused. They were also the worst performing sectors of 2022. But over a long period of time, they tend to be the most pronounced, best outperforming sectors. So you need some exposure. Now, everybody has exposure to tech through indexes and through technology funds, et cetera. But our work still suggests that people have a chronic and massive underweight to consumer discretionary stocks in particular, as well as staples. And that's always been very odd to me, given that it's a 70% consumer economy, and yet everybody's underweight the thing that drives 70% of the economy, which is why we started the fund, FYI. And then lastly, on the third, our willingness to embrace volatility when it arrives and trade around the core positions, or take decisive action when we see short-term tactical trading opportunities. If I'm sitting on some cash and I see an opportunity to step out of cash, buy something on sale that looks like it's about to inflect higher, to, you know, get out of cash, get in the stock or brand, get paid over a, you know, 1 week to 3 week period, and then step back into cash, that is a wonderful use of cash. If I can earn the full year's dividend or more in a trade that lasts less than 1 month, that's a pretty good use of capital, in my opinion. So in a market driven by CTAs and algos and one day to expiration options trading, investors just have to get more comfortable with periodic bouts of volatility. It just is the way it is. You either don't expose yourself to stocks and don't get the long-term great returns that come generally from stocks, or you have to absorb some of the volatility. And most importantly, you or your advisor or your money managers, you know, just outsource the volatility management to people who are good at it, comfortable with it, and love it. And we certainly love volatility, because that's when really good discounts happen, and we get to take advantage of those things. So, you know, the Buffett people used to talk, you know, the Berkshire people used to talk about volatility being the friend of the long-term investor. These short-term periods offer wonderful opportunities to generate attractive returns if you can absorb some of the volatility. So what worked in 2023? Certainly mega caps. I mean, we all got inundated with, you know, the market hasn't really done anything except for the top 10 names or something, which, you know, it's a nice catchy headline, but it's not true. Certainly there were some big gains in the mega cap brands that we concentrate in, but there were plenty of other great returns. And I'll talk about some of those in a minute, but some of our core holdings that we've held for years and years, Microsoft was up 58% on the year. Amazon was up 80%. Meta was up 194% after having a really tough 2022. I mean, the thing was down about 65% in 2022. So naturally it ripped back because the market overreacted. Google was up 58, Apple was up 49, Eli Lilly was up 60, Lululemon was up 59, Costco was up 49. So big gains, outsized gains in some really important, really great businesses, all of which are core holdings of the brand strategy. Now, again, these numbers sound pretty incredible, and they are, but one, if you widen your lens a bit and you look at the 2 and the 3 year returns of many great companies and the market overall, you realize how much opportunity there still is in markets as we enter 2024, just from a mean reversion opportunity. You know, again, the thesis is if the market does 8 to 10% over a long period of time, and we have, you know, over 100 years of data to support that, the best businesses should compound greater than that. I use 13%, 15%, whatever the number is. If you anchor to great businesses that have good growth characteristics and good balance sheets and good growth opportunities here and abroad, those companies should do even better than the market. Not every year, but over time, they tend to do that. And that's, there's a lot of data that supports that. So the market has lagged over the last couple of years because of inflation, because of the disruption in 2022. So we are still well off of the long-term path and return streams of equities over a short period of time. And over time, we will catch back up to the long. That's the beauty of averages, right? When you're well above average over a short period of time, you probably mean revert lower, aka from 2021 and 2022. When you are well under the long-term averages, over time, you mean revert back to the long-term average, which is higher. Obviously, the economy, the direction of the economy matters to that trajectory and when it happens. But, you know, as we enter 2024, we're pretty constructive about a Fed who's done raising interest rates, inflation that's still on a trajectory back to where it should be, a cost of capital that might get easier, less uncertainty, which you know, de-anchors people from all their caution, and all of that stuff tends to be pretty good. And I'll throw out some stats here in a minute about a Goldilocks economy from a Fed funds and inflation perspective, looking back over the last 55 years. So, you know, just again, for some perspective, the 2 year number for the S&P is a subpar 3.26% or 1.6% annualized. And the NASDAQ 100 is a much better. So even the NASDAQ, the great NASDAQ that was up 55% last year, is well off of its long-term averages. If I look at our top holding and my favorite stock in the portfolio now, Amazon, that's about 15% of the fund currently. And every time it goes down, I'm going to buy more. That Amazon's annualized at -4.5% for 2 years and -2.3% over 3 years. Now, for perspective, from the IPO to in mid-1997 till the end of 2019, just before the pandemic began, Amazon annualized at 31%. Now, I'm not expecting a 31% annualized return, you know, for the next 3 years or so, but if the brand is as relevant or more as it always has been that generated those great returns, and it is, and if they have more growth levers to pull than ever before, and they're returning to strong free cash flow and net income, then the stock is going to work again. Because, you know, over the last couple of years, because of the pandemic, Amazon pulled forward a massive amount of spending to build out the logistics business to satisfy all the demand. All of that money that they spent pulled down free cash flow and net income all the way to negative, right? The stock historically lags badly in spending cycles. And then once they monetize those spending cycles, the stock plays major catch up. And that's where I think we are over the next, you know, couple of years. And that's why we're so overweight Amazon today. And there's a lot of great brands that have a similar setup that have, you know, strong history of returns, are better businesses, more efficient businesses, better profitability that's sustainable, and have lagged on the stock price for the last couple of years. We have about 55% of the fund is in kind of names like that, Live Nation is another one of those stocks, which is the second largest holding. Big, strong outperformance history, lagging over the last couple of years for obvious reasons. In most of the world, you couldn't go to a concert. And the demand is still robust. Their margin structure is much better. Demand is higher. They're printing money, generating a lot of free cash, expanding the business, getting more venues. And there's just a lot of demand that's going to filter in. And the stock does not reflect it by any stretch. So the stock's, you know, in the high 80s. And I think it's, you know, the goal for us is over 120 over the next year or two. Excuse me. So brands that another thing that worked in 2023 were brands that crossed into profitability for the first time. There, when a company goes from growing but not profitable and inflects higher, there's usually a pretty good lift in the stock price. So one of the holdings that we have that was a big winner in the sports betting area was DraftKings. We still own it. We still love it. It had a phenomenal year, up 209% after a struggle in 2022. Also, the leader in ride-sharing, Uber, was up 149% as free cash flow sustainability seems to have been reached. And the stock was also added to the S&P 500. They got a big lift there. Latin American e-commerce brand and kind of the Amazon of Latin America, and a fintech leader, Mercado Libre, they were up. That stock was up 85%. So it wasn't just the mega cap Mag 7 that performed in 2023. And then another category is our alternative asset manager basket of Blackstone, KKR, and Apollo. You know, if you have an advisor, they've probably talked to you about putting, you know, giving up some liquidity and giving some money to some of the greatest investors in the world across private equity, private credit, infrastructure, you know, differentiated real estate, et cetera. Blackstone was up 82% on the year. KKR was up 80. Apollo was up 49. There is a significant demand from high net worth investors across private market assets. And most of the money goes to a narrower group of companies. And that's why we own this basket. These brands stand to benefit greatly, you know, and importantly, if your clients opt for giving up a little liquidity to gain access to private, you know, markets, these brands win. But if your clients aren't comfortable carving out some liquidity for private markets, you can, but you do identify that there's a major trend and theme across asset allocation, you can benefit by owning the stocks as we do in the fund. That's why a lot of our advisors actually use the fund, because it gives us, because it gives their clients a really good sneaky way to get access to the theme without having to give up some liquidity. And they let us manage the basket. And we do trade around the stocks. I've added to Blackstone when it was down significantly. And, you know, thankfully we did, because the stock was up 82% on the year for last year. And, you know, here's a fun fact. Most top tier asset managers on the alternative side have generated really exceptional returns for clients over time. So giving up some liquidity has paid them handsomely, but, you know, and logic would tell you the stocks of these great brands should be strong performers if their business was strong, and it was. Obviously, at zero interest rates, these companies raised a gazillion dollars of capital that they still have to put to work. And that was a great time for, certainly for private equity, when you can borrow cheap and lever it up a little bit and buy good companies and then sell them and realize those gains for LPs. So, you know, if you just look at the, you know, since the IPO, for instance, Blackstone and went IPO July 2000, kind of right at the wrong time, but some might argue they knew that they were getting liquid at the end of the cycle. Blackstone annualized at 14.5% up until today since the IPO. And it's pretty similar to their private equity returns. So some might even say that, you know, if you believe in the theme and you know that these companies are dominant and that they should generate some good returns, just buy the stocks. That's an incredibly logical, common sense conclusion. The reality is most people don't own these stocks. They're not represented in ETFs very well. And, you know, if I look at most funds and ETFs, they're just not there. So these are really amazing businesses that have a strong history of great returns, and they're not represented in most people's portfolio, which again, you either buy them yourself or let us manage the basket, but lots of advisors are doing just that with our fund. You know, Apollo has annualized at 22% since the IPO in April of 2011. KKR has annualized at 21% since their public debut in July of 2010. So these are great businesses that have generated great returns. They can be volatile stocks because they are kind of levered equities, if you will. And so you get a chance, they're great trading stocks because you get a chance to buy them when the market, you know, has a hissy fit and they have outsized returns on the downside. But don't forget that they are wonderful businesses that are growing. And KKR and Apollo are absolutely going to reach the $1 trillion assets mark like Blackstone has. And so there might even be more upside in KKR and Apollo just because they're following the Blackstone playbook. But all three of them still have to put about 300 plus billion of dry powder to work over time, which means that they have a step up in earnings and free cash flow and FRE and DE, which is distributed earnings over time. And their multiples do not reflect the stability of businesses that have a half a trillion or $1 trillion in assets and recurring fees, plus lots of dry powder to put to work at good prices. So we still love that basket, even after having a pretty wonderful 2023. So let's just kind of round up with our current views of 2024. We do expect interest rates and inflation data to be pretty range bound and volatile. Like tomorrow we have a CPI print. It would not shock me at all if we see a little bit hotter of a print. And I'm frankly wondering how the market's going to react. And remember, we're very algorithmic driven, which is just means that it's rules based. So there's certainly some potential sell programs that could come in if we get a hotter print, which means that the Fed isn't going to be able to reduce interest rates at the trajectory and the timing that people expect. That's going to be an opportunity in our eyes, certainly to add to what likely goes down, aka high beta and tech, because I want to get more big in tech on dips, particularly with the AI theme just, you know, like in inning one. So just expect the data to, you know, on a monthly basis to be volatile. And because of trading around data points, you might have a chance to get an opportunity to buy some things that you like on a dip that is just a short-term overreaction. So the another theme is those 2 and 3 year laggards like Amazon, Live Nation, Nike, a few others, to return to their former glory as the normalization process continues. And again, about 55% of the portfolio could be classified in that kind of great business, has a long history of great returns, but has lagged significantly over the last couple of years. And we see that mean reversion over the next couple of years. We do expect some rolling corrections around sectors and industries to continue. We saw it all year last year. And so you just take advantage of it. You know, again, we tend to cluster in technology, comm services, and consumer discretionary. But if we see some opportunities in some other areas, let's say we get a hot CPI print tomorrow, interest rates move up a little bit, tech moves down a little bit. Maybe even REITs move down a little bit. The interest rate sensitive sectors pull back. You might get an opportunity to add to some of those names. We see more geopolitics and U.S. political antics that could spark some short-term volatility. That's always the case. We'll just adapt to whatever we see when we see that volatility. We do expect the quality style factor that includes strong free cash flow, good ROEs, stable, predictable earnings, and solid balance sheets to continue to perform. So we're continuously overweight that in the portfolio. A broadening of the return should happen as more stocks participate. We got a glimpse of that in Q4 with small and mid-cap companies performing much better. But we see this broadening out more happening more towards the middle of the year to the end of the year rather than right now. And thus far, we've seen mega caps be where the money has been flowing so far in the first, you know, 2 weeks of 2024. The economy could slow maybe a little bit further into Q2 as the effects of Fed tightening continue to affect, you know, secondary businesses in particular, and particularly those that need refinancing. But that will allow us to just get more exposure to industries and leading brands that we admire if we see a little bit of that weakness, because we do have that thesis that the economy is running on two of four cylinders, not because it is just weak, but because the Fed has manipulated it to be weak. And it's not going to do that forever. It can't do that forever. Eventually, we're going to get back to trend growth. And when that happens, it wouldn't shock me again if rates go up a little bit. That's when maybe more value-oriented, more cyclical, more small cap companies should tend to perform. Maybe at the expense of mega cap. It's really hard to know in a world where ETFs drive everything. And so when you put your money in the S&P ETF, you're just getting mega cap too. It's a massive part of the overall index, but that certainly should happen. So we see a bit of a Goldilocks scenario from an economic perspective, understanding that there's volatility always along the way. The consumer is still likely going to stay a bit stingy about where they spend. Trade down activity should continue for, you know, 2/3 of the consumer base at the lower income cohorts. Wealthier consumers are even being more disciplined about where they spend, what categories they're spending on. Brand relevance, brand love, high brand loyalty is absolutely where we see the best opportunities. Because if you're going to spend your money, you're going to do it in places you're really passionate about or in areas that you really absolutely just can't live without, like a Costco or spending with your Visa card, or if you need apparel, maybe you go to TJX, et cetera. Consumer sentiment should improve as the wealth effect and job security keep them pretty engaged in their favored spending categories. And, you know, consumer sentiment is still well off of normal areas. So there's a lot of improvement in that area. And again, you know, once we feel more comfortable about the future, our sentiment improves, our spending improves. If we get a better job, it improves. We have the ability to spend, and wages are still pretty strong because there's a bit of a labor and a, you know, and skills mismatch in the economy. We pretty much stopped immigration, and we just need more people for the jobs that we have. There's a pretty big lack of skilled labor and even unskilled labor, which keeps wages high, which keeps, you know, people spending. So again, our focus is experiences, travel, e-commerce, discount shopping, and wellness, as well as that alternatives, you know, more money migrating into alternatives across retail as well as institutional. So let's kind of end with this non-consensus view over some, you know, some data points that we've uncovered. We do have sufficient data that there was a lot of FOMO, fear of missing out at the latter part of last year, as lots of people underperformed and the markets kind of just ripped away from people that were waiting for a pullback that didn't come. That helped drive the market up after a slight pullback in late October. We would consider these FOMO flows to be a little transitory and kind of non-committed capital. And we do see a little bit of proof in the new year of that. In the week ending January 3rd, investors moved $123 billion of capital back into money market funds. Now, there's certainly been a lot of flows into QQQ, the ETF, and some, you know, kind of the technology and AI theme, as well as crypto and even some biotech, and because of some M&A activity. But that move into money markets was the largest amount ever to start a new year, which comes from Bank of America research. So right now, money markets in the U.S. have about $6 trillion, and it's earning less than it used to year over year. And globally, there's about $8 trillion in money markets. So some of this money will eventually de-anchor from fear-based allocations and shift into more risky assets like bonds and stocks and private alternatives. Portfolios that have been positioned overly defensively will also need to get right-sized as the economy starts to heal. So that's a lot of fuel that could come back into the market and should come back into the market. Timing is always uncertain, but again, when you feel a little bit better, you decide to put money, more money into risk assets and take more risk, and that helps the equity markets over time. So there is a significant number of opinions predicting and predictions based on the direction of Fed funds and inflation over the next year or two, and then how equities and bonds to some degree, but our focus is on equities and how equities should do in that regard. Obviously, if you are a bear and you're anchored, there's no data that can change your mind, but we're certainly not going to get into the predicting game of what the Fed and what interest rates are going to do. There's just too many variables, and I've never really seen an edge trying to predict the future. We focus on business fundamentals and consumer spending trends, and that's where we have a big edge over most of our peers. So we did some research late last year and looked at how the S&P 500 tended to perform in different periods of Fed funds and CPI. And, you know, there is this narrative that the best returns come from zero interest rates, and the economy and the markets just can't perform with rates where they are today and CPI and inflation where they are today. And that's just not true. You know, we got into this mode after 08 of interest rates were at zero to thinking that was normal. And that is not normal. If you look back prior to 2008, 50 years, average Fed funds is where they are right around today in the 4 to 5.5% range. And average CPI is actually 3%. It's just this abnormal period of 08 through 21 and 22 that people think that's normal. And it's just not. So interesting data here. Our base case for 2024 and probably 2025 is for a Fed funds rate, and where I think we're around 5.25, somewhere around there now, for Fed funds to anchor a little bit lower. Let's call it, you know, 4 to 5%. I'd say if you had to put a number on it, they would average somewhere between 4 and 4.5%, with inflation averaging kind of in that 2 to 4% range for a variety of reasons, just how the calculation of inflation is and what parts of inflation are sticky in the economy. So, you know, as it turns out, looking back, you know, since 1971, the S&P 500 has been in that range of 2 to 4% inflation, 4 to 5% Fed funds, 2 to 4% inflation, 11 times over the last 53 years. Those years were 2023, market did pretty well, 2007, 2006, 1999, 1997, 1996, 1995, 1994, 1991, 1972, and 1971. If you average all of those 11 years, it shows an average S&P 500 return of 20% with no down calendar years. Now, I'm certainly not going to anchor to the 20% because that's well above average. But, you know, if you think about it, that's not out of the realm of possibility. I just told you that over the last couple of years, the S&P is well below average. So in order to get to average, you probably have to have above average return. So, you know, but I'm not going to expect that. But the moral of the story is the returns, the market did really well when Fed funds was where it is and where it's going to be likely headed, as long as we don't continue to have Fed funds and inflation and interest rates rising. That's the problem. And we don't see that. The Fed is largely on hold for the foreseeable future. If anything, they're probably going to get a little less tight going forward. The sectors that performed the best over those years, now all sectors did pretty well in those years, obviously, if your average return is 20%, but tech, consumer discretionary, and healthcare were the top performing sectors. So our strategy should be pretty well geared for good performance if we kind of turn to those kinds of returns in a, you know, in a Fed funds inflation regime like we probably see, and like the years when in the look back that it was similar. Food for thought, that is not something that people talk about. That is not people's base case. That is not a consensus view. In fact, most Wall Street strategists for 2024 have returns for the S&P just above where they are. So there isn't much bullishness still, other than maybe Ed Yardeni, as well as Tom, I forget his name, who was right last year and wrong 2022. So most people aren't expecting much out of returns for 2024. The market might surprise us, even if there's some volatility along the way. So just a reminder, in the brands portfolio, and this is generally the case, in aggregate, this is a very high quality portfolio that you can, that help you sleep at night, with attractive sales and earnings growth projections for the names that we own, filled with free cash flow generators that have strong histories of compounding those investments at a highly attractive rate, tied to the most important theme driving every major economy. So I don't know how somebody doesn't have some dedication to this theme, whether it's with us or someone else. And again, the reason we created the fund and the strategy is because most people don't. If there were 100 options for doing what we do, I wouldn't have created this strategy with AccuVest. That would have been idiotic on my part. So there is a need for this theme, some exposure there, as well as anchoring to the great brands, because they have great long-term track records of success. And remember, purchase price matters. And if you aren't good at buying dips and panics, then turn it over to somebody who is and who loves that kind of thing. So thank you for your loyalty if you own the fund, and for appreciating the value of this $50 trillion global consumption theme and through great brands. And I'm always here. Global Brands Matter is the website, globalbrandsmatter.com, to chat. Thanks a lot, and happy new year. And let's have a great 2024. Thanks for listening to Mega Brands, everybody. I'm your host, Eric Clark. For more information on this podcast and to learn more about the brand relevancy scoring system we use, be sure to check out the website at globalbrandsmatter.com. While you're there, make sure to sign up for the market newsletter and check out my latest thoughts on our favorite portfolio brands in the Dynamic Brands section. If you have any questions or want to learn more about the Dynamic Brands approach, send me a message on the contact tab. Thanks again for listening, everybody. Have a great day.